going to go and continue our theme here, talking about the criminalization of environmental protests. And I thought we couldn't do a special without talking a little bit about Judy Berry. Judy Berry was a renowned environmental and labor activist from California, and she was active with Earth First in the early 90s. She organized nonviolent protests against destructive corporate logging of the redwood forests. Judy Berry and her partner and fellow activist Daryl Cherney were nearly killed in 1990. That's when a bomb exploded in their car while they were promoting the Redwood Summer Campaign. Instead of investigating the bombing as attempted murder, the FBI and Oakland police tried to frame Judy and Daryl for the bombing. They said they accused them of knowingly transporting the bomb that nearly killed them and ran a nationwide smear campaign of them and their activities. They basically said it was their own bomb and that it blew up in their car, unknowingly of them. So no charges were ever officially laid against Judy and Daryl, but the FBI used this pretext of investigating the bombing as a cover for a nationwide investigation of the organization Earth First. Judy and Daryl, in response, launched a civil rights lawsuit against the FBI and the Oakland police back in 91. Several years ago, they did win their lawsuit finally and were awarded $4.4 million. The jury in the case found the FBI and Oakland police. They found that they had framed Judy and Daryl in an effort to crush Earth First and chill participation in that campaign called Redwood Summer. No one has ever been charged in the bombing of Judy and Daryl, and Judy Berry died of breast cancer back in 1997. So we're going to play a couple tracks off a CD called Who Bombed Judy Berry? And you can find the full audio of the CD at www.judyberry.org. It's spelled J-U-D-I-B-A-R-I.org. So this first track is called Redwood Summer.
Government tried to kill Earth First 'cause we wouldn't compromise. They thought that they could scare us and discredit our cause by using fear and violence like common outlaws. But Redwood Summer ain't gonna be stopped this way. 'Cause people gonna stand together for to make a better day. No, Redwood Summer ain't gonna be stopped this way. We're gonna stand together for to make a better day.
Now Judy and Daryl went out driving in a car to go talk about Redwood Summer, but they didn't get very far. As a bomb was exploded to make their cause fail, it put Judy in the hospital and Daryl in jail.
People gonna stand together for to make a better day. No, Redwood Summer ain't gonna be stopped this way. 'Cause people gonna stand together for to make a better day.
Though Judy and Daryl had their lives threatened before, the police said that they made the bomb and they wouldn't do a damn thing more. Tried to find the true blood, it had a hollow ring. Outside the county buildings, we sang and we prayed. We screamed out protest to the sky in the weather, cold and gray. And the Mother Earth was weeping for those that had been cut down. For her two brave defenders set up in Oakland town. But
Redwood Summer this way, 'cause people gonna stand together for to make a better day. No, Redwood Summer ain't gonna be stopped this way, 'cause people
people gonna stand together for to make a better day? No, Redwood summer ain't gonna be stopped this way. 'Cause people gonna stand together for to make a better day. No, Redwood summer ain't gonna be stopped this way. 'Cause people gonna stand together for to make a better day. For to make a better day. For to make a better day.
Explosion tore through a car being driven by two Earth First activists on an Oakland street today. Both are alive and have been hospitalized. The incident occurred just before noon near the corner of Park and MacArthur Boulevards near Oakland High School. Earth First activist Judy Berry was seriously hurt with facial injuries and a pelvic fracture. Daryl Cherney suffered lacerated eyes and ears. Both are at Highland Hospital. Berry has just come out of exploratory surgery. She's in serious but stable condition. Oakland police apparently think that the two may have been transporting explosives. They're also looking into the possibility of a car bomb. Both Cherney and Berry are key organizers of the Redwood Summer, an attempt to bring hundreds of environmental activists to Mendocino and Humboldt counties to use nonviolent civil disobedience to save old-growth forests.
So when the bomb exploded, it was May 24th, 1990, and we were on our way to a concert in Santa Cruz where we were going to play songs and show a slideshow and recruit for a Redwood Summer among the college students there. And I can't even describe how horrible it was. I can tell you I knew it was a bomb the second that it exploded. I felt it rip through me with just a force more powerful and terrible than anything that I could describe. But the horror of this experience didn't end with the bombing itself, because within minutes of the bombing, the FBI terrorist squad from the San Francisco FBI office was on the scene. And I literally mean this, within minutes, certainly within a half hour. According to their own records, the first record we have of their being on the scene is a log by the Oakland police. And 25 minutes after the bomb explodes, they recount their conversations with the FBI agents. So they were there pretty fast, considering that this was in Oakland and that FBI office is in San Francisco. And what the FBI did, arriving on the scene immediately, actually my lawyer wrote in the brief, the FBI was there in a trice, almost as if they had been standing around the corner holding their ears. But at any rate, whether or not they were standing around the corner holding their ears, they were certainly there quickly, and what they did was they quickly kind of took control of the scene. And they talked to the Oakland police, who were the responding agency. And what they did is they said to the Oakland police, they said, we know these people. These people are terrorists. And literally what they said, this was testified by Sergeant Sitterud of the Oakland police. He said, they told us that these were the kind of people who would carry a bomb. They told us that these people, in fact, qualified as terrorists. So with that, the Oakland police were a lot more willing to, they have a long relationship with the FBI anyway, certainly going back to the days of the Black Panthers, and with this stuff being told to them by the FBI, they were willing to cooperate. But it's not just that they, accidentally thought that I bombed myself. What we've found is that they told some very, very deliberate lies. And you can't really excuse the Oakland police for going along with it, because these lies were so obvious that anybody with a set of eyes in their head could have seen them. First thing they said, and this was from FBI Special Agent Frank Doyle, and Frank Doyle was their bomb expert on the terrorist squad. And it actually says in the warrant for the search warrant, where there's a warrantless arrest, so there is no arrest warrant. So the reasons for the arrest are laid out in the search warrant. And what it says in there is it says, the Oakland police say, I viewed the bombed car along with Special Agent Frank Doyle of the FBI. Frank Doyle informed me that the bomb was on the backseat floorboard, and therefore they should have seen it, and therefore they knew that they were carrying it. Well, years later, as this lawsuit has progressed, we've gotten hold of the Oakland police's own photos. Now, the place where Frank Doyle testified the bomb was right where you put your feet when you're sitting in the back seat. And this, of course, is under the seat. And any idiot could see this. I mean, Ray Charles could see this. You don't have to be a bomb expert to see that this bomb was not in the back seat. So at that point began an incredible press smear from the moment that this bomb went off. Went an incredible press smear nationwide. It's the only time we ever made the front page of the New York Times. And what this press smear was to tell people that we were terrorists who had blown ourselves up with our own bomb. And this, although we can't get anything that we actually do, we can't get it in the newspapers, this one got picked up all over the place. And there were selected leaks and innuendos given out by the FBI and the Oakland police in order to convince people that not only are we violent terrorists who carry bombs around in our car, but we're stupid violent terrorists who carry them under our own car seat.
Now Judy Barry is a wobbly organizer, a Mother Jones at the Georgia Pacific Mill. She fought for the sawmill workers hit by that PCB spill. T. Marshall Hunt's calling GD shots from Atlanta. Don Nelson sold him the Union long ago. Now they weren't gonna have no wobbly running their logging show. So they spewed out their hatred and they laid out their scam. Jerry Philbrick called for violence. Was no secret what they planned. So I'm asking now, who bombed Judy Barry? I know you're out there still. Have you seen her broken body?
And you're listening to the track Who Bombed Judy Barry, and that is off a CD called Who Bombed Judy Barry. Before that, you actually heard the voice of Judy Barry talking about the bombing that she went through in 1990. And you can find all the audio tracks off that CD, Who Bombed Judy Barry, at the website www.judybarry.org. And again, Judy Barry was an environmentalist and a labor activist in California. She was active with Earth First in the early 90s. We're looking at the issue of criminalizing environmental activism. And there's been a lot going on in the states in the last couple of years. And there's something, the new sort of crackdown on environmentalists in the states has been called the Green Scare. It's a term that's relatively recently been coined in the U.S., and it's alluding to the Red Scare of the 40s and 50s. It refers to recent actions taken by all branches of the U.S. government against the environmental and animal rights movement. It specifically targets groups and individuals who support these movements. So it includes things such as the Shack 7, which I'll talk about in a little while. It's a group of animal rights activists who have been targeted for their work on a website. Also those persecuted by Operation Backfire and recipients of a disproportionate sentences, and that includes Jeffrey Free Lures. Jeffrey received a sentence of 22 years for lighting three SUVs on fire back in 2000. So that's 22 years since he's currently serving. So we're going to listen to a music collage that brings you a little bit of perspective about the Green Scare and some of the recent arrests in the United States. We're going to hear segments of a speech by Lauren Regan. She's the executive director of the Civil Liberties Defense Center in Oregon. And so in this piece, she's mostly talking about Operation Backfire. That's an FBI operation targeting environmental activists through indictments, grand juries, and incarceration. So she was speaking as a part of a forum that was held last June in New York City. And this piece was produced by Pop Defect Radio, and their website is popdefectradio.blogspot.com.
That this presentation will serve to give to you a better knowledge and a deeper understanding of your FBI. FBI. Your FBI. FBI. Your FBI.
The FBI has engaged in an orchestrated campaign of unprecedented surveillance, grand jury subpoenas to environmental activists, conducting large-scale roundups of activists, levying unprecedented charges and penalties for property crimes. We've also seen the use of threats of severe sanctions to leverage fear in these individuals of conviction, which then forces in these people's minds the choice to turn into government informants. We've dubbed this witch hunt the Green Scare, obviously, as you've heard from other speakers, hearkening to the 1950s and the Red Scare. During the Red Scare, the word was communist, and it didn't really matter whether you were one or not. If they labeled you that, ramifications flowed from that. In this, the modern era, the Green Scare, the term is eco-terrorist. And again, it doesn't matter whether you are or you're not. If they label you as that, there are ramifications. The difference between the Red Scare and the Green Scare is, in this circumstance, the roundup is of environmentalists or anarchists. And the government has chosen to target these particular groups because they are on the fringe, because some of their views are radical. Their views are sometimes clearly not in accord with the government's views. And this has resulted in the Justice Department engaging in runaway prosecutions. Runaway prosecutions and trumped up charges based on what's clearly becoming evidence as a political agenda. Local police, FBI, and other federal agents have infiltrated meetings, public meetings. They've taken pictures of lawful protesters at lawful demonstrations. They've asked employers, neighbors, and fellow citizens about individuals expressing political views that used to be protected by the First Amendment. They continue to gain vast resources to execute these searches and these programs from federal coffers that were intended to fight terrorism.
FBI, get your hands up!
The FBI. Fidelity. Bravery. And integrity. The world is today witnessing a giant ideological battle, a battle for the hearts, minds, and souls of men, women, and children. This is the danger which we face today.
On December 7th, 2005, one of the largest roundups of environmental and animal liberation activists in the history of the United States began. Using codename Operation Backfire, the FBI arrested seven people in four states initially. Chelsea Gerlach, William Rogers, Kendall Tankersley, Kevin Tubbs, Daniel McGowan, and Stanislaus Meyerhoff were arrested for allegedly taking part in a wide variety of actions the government is attributing to the ELF and ALF, Earth Liberation Front and Animal Liberation Front. The chart that I have up on the screen right now is the United States sentencing guidelines from their own website. You'll see that the average sentence for arson in the federal system is 5 years. Murder, 247.5 months, and some of these other really, really serious charges, you know, they're giving you some average amounts of jail time that these types of crimes warrant across the United States. Well, in these cases, the people are alleged to have committed property damage, not murder, arson. You know, if you want to call it that, call it arson. The burning of property. And as you can see, approximately 5 years is the average sentence. Well, these people are looking at life plus, at the maximum, life plus 1,115 years in prison for alleged crimes of arson. You don't see those numbers anywhere on this little chart, of course.
And you are listening to a music collage about the Green Scare, and you're listening to Lauren Regan. She's the executive director of the Civil Liberties Defense Center in Oregon. This is Stark Raven on Co-op Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM. We're doing a special on criminalization of the environmental movement. And the Green Scare is a term that's been recently coined in the United States, and it's alluding to the Red Scare of the 40s and 50s. And we're going to go now and hear just the ending piece of this musical collage that was produced by Pop Defect Radio, and then we'll be back and talking a little bit more about criminalization of animal rights protesters.
And this is not the first time that the FBI has unfairly targeted environmental activists. The Judy Berry case, she was a labor activist, environmental activist, who was blown up in her car, and the feds accused her of carrying bombs and blowing herself up. 10 years later, in a civil suit, she won $4.1 million from the FBI because she did not blow herself up, and in fact, there was a police and FBI conspiracy to do so. The FBI is currently defining eco-terrorism as the use or threatened use of violence of a criminal nature against innocent victims or property by an environmentally oriented subnational group for environmental political reasons or aimed at an audience beyond the target, often of a symbolic nature. This definition of terrorism criminalizes holding a banner, marching in the street, throwing a rock through a window. All of those petty vandalism crimes now fall within the gamut of terrorism under these definitions. We have to take back the power of words and of the law. We have to control the language. That is very, very important. We have to question what the government is pumping out in its PR spin and look at the facts. They are available on the internet more widely than ever before, and we really need to be challenging these words and the propaganda and the pushing of a political agenda that will result in people, human beings, serving the rest of their lives in jail.
And that was, again, Lauren Regan, the executive director of the Civil Liberties Defense Center in Oregon. And she was talking about Operation Backfire, and that is a FBI operation targeting environmental activists through various indictments, grand juries, and incarceration. And many of the defendants she was talking about have pled guilty and made plea bargains with the government. Sentencing hearings are scheduled in the next couple of months for those people. And for more information, you can check out a couple of websites. One is greenscare.org, and the Green Scare page on portland.indymedia.org is also useful. And there is also a full talk by Lauren Regan. You can find links to that at the Pop Defect Radio website, popdefectradio.blogspot.com. I'm going to talk a little bit now about some environmental activists, some animal rights activists, excuse me, who have been targeted by the state. It's the Shack 7, they're known as. There are six activists and one corporation, and the corporation is Stop Huntington Animal Cruelty, or Shack. These folks were convicted in March of last year under the controversial U.S. Animal Enterprise Protection Act. The act punishes anyone who physically disrupts an animal enterprise. The charges stem from these activists' alleged participation in an international campaign to close the notorious product testing lab, Huntington Life Sciences, or HLS. The six individuals are all currently in federal prison in the United States. They're not accused of actually smashing windows, liberating animals, or even attending demonstrations. Rather, they're charged with reporting on and encouraging others to engage in legal demonstrations and supporting the ideology of direct action. Specifically, these activists are alleged to have operated a website. This website reported on and expressed ideological support for the protest activity against Huntington Life Sciences and its business affiliates. And it's for this that they were charged with terrorism, not any actual action, but the operating of a website. So they're now serving sentences of between 1 and 6 years in U.S. federal prisons. They are appealing their convictions. For more information on them, you can go to shack7.com. And since the Shack 7 convictions last year, the U.S. government has actually updated the Animal Enterprise Protection Act. And now it's called the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. And so the new act, for people who are engaging in nonviolent civil disobedience, If this civil disobedience causes a company to lose more than $10,000 in profit, then those people are considered terrorists. And if you're convicted, people are facing massive fines and jail time. The new act has a chilling effect on U.S. First Amendment rights to free speech. An activist believes that the true purpose of the act is to severely limit animal rights activism by intimidating those who would legally protest. So for more information on the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, there is a website that was set up to try and stop its implementation. It's www.stopaeta, that's the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, .org. So those are some of the pretty big cases that are happening in the states around some of the criminalization of environmental activism. And we weren't able to get Preeti Krajicek to call in from prison, but we're going to speak with Monica Sheardown, and she's a supporter of Betty and has followed her through her trial. So we're going to talk to her in a couple of minutes about the use of criminal contempt of court and how that's been used in Preeti Krajicek's case. We're going to go now to a song by Po Girl, and then we'll be back, and we're going to be talking with Monica Sheardown about Betty Krajicek and criminal contempt of court on Co-op Radio 102.7 FM.
And yeah, I'm excited to play this track from Po Girl because I bumped into them at Britannia Pool a couple months ago, and they're doing a world tour now. So, local band, and now they're traveling the world. We're very proud of you, Po Girl.
Just blame the whiskey. 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, I have seen a lot of things round here. I have seen a lot of things round here. Seen a lot of things around here. I have seen a lot of things around here. Around here. I have seen a lot of things around here. I have seen a lot of things around here. Around here. I have seen a lot of things around here. I have seen a lot of things around here. To a place I know of inspiration divine. Talking about the front line at the revolution's end. Inspired, I know I've got to be to get my message to the people of the vision that I see. The front line, front line, front line at the revolution's end. Whoa.
Yes, well, there's no other title on this album. I'm moving it around. It is called Po Girl, self-titled, as they say out there. You're listening to Star Craven on Co-op Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM. And we were trying to get Betty Crosrick to call us from the Alouette Correctional Center for Women, where she's being held on a 10-month sentence. Unfortunately, we weren't able to connect with her, but hopefully we'll be able to speak with her on an upcoming show, perhaps in May or June, to talk to her about her case and also what's going on for her in the prison. But we are doing a special for this first hour on Stark Raven on the criminalization of environmental activism. So I thought it was quite appropriate to talk to Betty. She is a 78-year-old who spent a total of almost 3 years in jail at various times for participation in anti-logging protests. Again, she's currently serving her sentence right now. It's 10 months, and it's for her stand against Olympic development at Eagle Ridge Bluffs. That's in West Vancouver on traditional Squamish territory. But she's been sent to jail not for breaking a law from the criminal code, but for disobeying a court order. And this is an approach the government and corporations are using to criminalize environmental activists. And we have with us on the phone Monica Sheardown, and she's a local environmentalist who's been working closely with Betty on her case. And she's going to tell us a little bit more about Betty's recent run-in with the criminal justice system and how the system has been criminalizing environmental activism. Thanks for joining us, Monica.
Of course, anytime.
So, Betty is currently in the Alouette Correctional Center for Women. I know you're in frequent contact with her. How's she doing there?
Well, Betty's a pretty strong lady. Her spirits are always quite high. She's very, very busy. She spends a lot of time writing. She keeps in touch with all the people on the outside. And she's also preparing her appeal. So all that's keeping her pretty busy.
So can you tell us more about Betty's involvement at Eagle Ridge Bluffs?
Sure. Betty became involved actually at the request of the Eagle Ridge Bluffs Coalition. Because it was in West Vancouver, it was sort of a unique situation where it involved people that had, most of them had never been involved in a protest before. You know, your average person in West Vancouver, that's is generally not the kind of person that you'll find on a picket line or a protest, especially an illegal one. So they asked Betty to come in because of her very strong record in working in environmental issues, starting with Clackwood Sound and Carmana Valley, et cetera, Walbrand Valley, sorry, where she was arrested as well, the Elijo Valley. So she's sort of, I guess, somewhat of an expert on blockades. And she actually went in and did a 2-day training for all the people that were intending to take part in the protest, explaining to them the ins and outs of how a blockade works, how to handle the police, how to handle the camp, how to handle the media. Just gave them a crash course on what they were about to experience and maybe try to reduce the stress of it a little bit, because there are, I guess, a lot of things that come up, including media and police, and to try to intimidate the protesters. So she gave him a bit of warning about that.
So she got a little more involved then after just doing a training.
Yeah, she did the training and then she stayed on and camped there herself. She set up her own tent. I think they were there for 2 months was the length of the protest. And that sort of is part of the issue of what's involved here. Those protesters could have been arrested at any time under the criminal code for interfering with the work at Eagle Ridge Bluffs. But as you said, the government uses a tool called injunctions. So rather than just having the police going in and arresting these protesters under our regular criminal laws, they were instructed to wait by the construction company, by Kiewit and Sons, that's building the Cedar Sky Highway, which is an American company, by the way, so just to add a bit of salt to the wound. What they did is they went and got a court order, an injunction, meaning that the protesters would essentially be in contempt of court if they were anywhere within a specific perimeter of the work area. So that meant that, so they wait, this takes a bit of time for the paperwork to go through, et cetera. So the police gets direct instructions from the construction company, and rather than, they're almost in collusion, in collusion with the construction company, because really it's their job just to go out and arrest people that are breaking the law. So they waited till the injunction came through. Then they were arrested for breaking the injunction, which is criminal contempt of court, rather than a democratic, nonviolent civil disobedience, where they could have argued in court about what they were doing there, why they were there, and the fact that they were protecting a threatened ecosystem.
So what are the main differences between this using the court order and this criminal contempt of court charge versus a traditional criminal trial and charge and trial?
Well, the regular criminal court, you're entitled to a trial jury, which is something that if Betty would obtain, she would most likely have a victory, because there are very few citizens who, once they hear about Betty's arguments about what she was doing there and what her motives were, that would consider her a criminal. So under the criminal code, you do have a right to a trial by jury. I'm probably not the most qualified to tell you the legal differences, the main thing is, that you're actually allowed to defend your case. So, for example, for a mass murderer, as we had most recently, he's allowed to say that he was temporarily insane and that it wasn't really his fault, and he could get off on all kinds of grounds. He could explain what happened. He could explain he had a traumatic childhood, all kinds of things. In the case of criminal contempt of court, they don't listen to any arguments about the crime. The only question is, were you present? Were you in the area where the injunction said that you weren't allowed to go? Yes or no? It's black and white, and it's clear that Betty was there. Hence, she's guilty. So that's the main issue about the injunctions, where you're sort of in a black hole.
And so is it actually the corporation who goes to the court to ask for this?
Yes, it is.
So it almost gives them more of a power to get involved and to restrict the movements of any people who are protesting against their actions.
Yes, it is. And, it's kind of an ominous situation when you think about the fact that the courts, which are supposed to be here for the citizens, for us, are actually seem to be working for the corporate interest, which is, most of us really don't have any run-in with that sort of situation and are not particularly aware of it. But in a situation like this where it becomes clear, I don't know the right word to use, but it's unnerving, I guess, to think that we live in a democratic system and then to realize that actually the courts are here protecting corporations and not the people.
So Betty received a 10-month sentence. I know many people reacted, quite strongly as to why she would get a 10-month sentence for standing on a road.
Right.
And what was the judge's justification, or how did that sentence come about?
There was a few reasons. The first one is that apparently there was blatant, I can't remember the exact word she used, but it was blatant and public, blatant, public, and repeated breaking of this injunction. So Betty, apparently the crime was that she was not doing this discreetly, but that she was getting a lot of media attention. So the fact that it was very public increased the magnitude of the crime, I suppose. And then it was argued that, you know, it's not up to Betty whether the newspapers or the media choose to, radio, of course, choose to cover the story or not. She was doing her thing, and if it attracts media attention, it attracts media attention. But basically, because the media was involved, that escalated the crime. And also, the judge said that she had encouraged other people to break the law as well. So she was a bad influence.
Maybe this explains also, at her sentencing, they put her in a high security courtroom, and checked everyone in this high security kind of way. Was the same courtroom used for the Air India trial or something like that?
Yeah.
And what was that all about?
It's the most secure and the largest courtroom at the Vancouver courts. And I think the main reason, I mean, obviously, I really don't see any of those protesters or, you know, really peace-loving tree huggers being dangerous or armed and dangerous in any way. But the main reason was just because of the size of the amount of support that she had, and it was a way of stopping people essentially from attending the proceedings. So what they did is they started to have people go through the security lineup half an hour before the trial started. Of course, nobody knew this because there were people that generally come to court and enter a courtroom just usually arrive maybe 5 or 10 minutes maximum before the trial begins. So there was probably at least, I think, about between 100 and 150 people that came to support Betty that day. And the last thing they wanted was a room full of angry environmentalists when the judge laid down this very long sentence. So they used this tactic, I guess, to decrease the number of people that had time to file into the room. They did really long, extensive searches on each person so that when 9 a.m. rolled around and it was time for Betty's sentencing to be given, about 12 of the 120 or odd people that were there had been cleared to enter the room.
And so what's next for Betty and her supporters?
Well, there's definitely still a lot of energy around this issue. Tomorrow morning, actually, Andrew Teasdale, who's one of the Eagle Ridge Bluffs protesters, is getting sentenced in criminal court tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. And Betty is definitely interested in launching an appeal. She feels that there are issues that have to be raised in the court that were not properly heard by the judge, and she's quite strong and determined to fight these injunctions. And essentially, she's fighting for our democratic system, our democratic right to nonviolent civil disobedience, which is, in her span of life, she's seen so many changes happen as a result of nonviolent civil disobedience, from ending the Vietnam War to women's rights. And the list continues. So she sees it as a very, very important part of our political system, and she's not giving up on making sure that we all enjoy those rights.
Yeah, and we're disappointed not to be able to speak to her this evening, but hope to be able to get her on the air here sometime on Starkraven in the next couple of months to hear her story.
I'm sure she would love to be on the air. She's a big fan of Co-op Radio.
She is also going to be on Co-op Radio Wednesday morning at 8 o'clock, you mentioned?
Yeah, I mean, she was supposed to call in tonight, too, and she's sort of on a bit of a restricted schedule over in the correctional center. But she's going to try to call in on Wednesday morning at 8 a.m., barring any other interruptions in her schedule.
And if people want to support her or contact her, what's the best way for them to show their support for Betty?
Well, she's always happy to get letters and cards if you want to write to Alouette Correctional Prison for Women. People are also sending in a few dollars here and there to help her cover her appeal costs. She's doing it all herself. There's about $10,000 she has to pay just to get the transcripts of the trial alone. So there's money involved, and people are helping to support that as well. So in whatever way you can do it, you can send if you want to know how to contact Betty and don't have any way of doing that, you can send me an email. I can give my email address if you like.
Okay.
It's Monica with a K, M-O-N-I-K-A, at greendreams.com. And I can send you information on how to get a letter or a donation to Betty.
Well, thanks very much for speaking with us this evening, Monica.
Most welcome, and have a beautiful evening.
You too. We were speaking with Monica Sheardown. She's a local environmentalist who's been working closely with Betty Croswick. Betty is an environmentalist who's currently in jail for her stand against Olympic development at Eagle Ridge Bluffs. She's serving a 10-month sentence in the Alouette Correctional Center for Women in Maple Ridge. For more information on Betty, you can check out her website, bettysearlyedition.blogspot.com.